You know, I just got to thinking as I was sitting there, there's about around 350 people in this room. And that's just about how many employees we have in our organization. So I guess I can share with you some of the stresses and strains and successes and the satisfactions out of welding a group of people together and moving forward in a positive, constructive way. And as I've already shared with you, some of the dangers if we don't pay attention to what we're doing. If we don't pay attention to our leadership responsibilities as individuals. And believe me, any of the difficulties and the problems that we might have in our organization are almost without exception people problems. The challenge and the opportunity of motivating people is the thing we face day in and day out, 365 days a year. And it can be done. Now, in our organization, we hire a lot of young people. And it's a lot of fun to see these folks come in. Folks that are just out of high school, or perhaps in college, and we hire a lot of folks who are waiters, busboys, kitchen personnel, that type of thing. And we have some standards. If you want to be, we have a slogan, it's fun to work at Farrell's. It is. It's a lot of fun. And do you know, we have more people to select from than most folks simply because we see to it that it is fun to work there. But it's interesting what makes it fun. Now, in the first place, somebody comes in. Nowadays, it's interesting, most folks look poor when they come in. They aren't poor, but they look poor. Bedraggled. Unkempt. It's amazing to me, but that's how they come in. And so the first position that we take is, we'd be happy to have you work here, but the first thing you need to do is to clean up. And I'm amazed at what a relief it is to so many young people to have somebody expect them to be clean. It seems like they're relieved. And we have a nice little uniform that these young ladies need to wear. And if you've ever been in one of these places, one of the things that happens time and time and time again in our organization is the compliments we get at the clean-cut, happy-looking young people that we've got working for us. So we say to a young man, you're welcome to work here. The first thing you need to do is to get a Farrell haircut. A Farrell haircut! You're going to tell me how to cut my hair? No, wear any kind of haircut you want. The question is, do you want to work here? Now, there isn't anything complicated about a Farrell haircut. It's just neat, that's all. And we are in a gay 90s organization, and so we encourage the boys to wear mustaches. And they have all kinds. But they've got to be neat. And they've got to be clean. And they've got to wear a certain kind of pants. And they've got to wear a certain kind of a shirt. And you know, there's something about being part of a team, being part of a group, and meeting a standard that these kids love. I think there's a real hunger in our day for young people to get behind somebody that's going somewhere and they know where they're going and they know what is expected of them and they can count on the fact that their leader will hold them to it. Oh yeah, they'll test the limits. They'll come in and they don't have their right pants on. Oh, forgot. That's all right. Go home and change them. Oh, but I live way across town. It's okay. Just go home and change them. Well, but can't I just wear these pants for today? You know, that happens over and over and over. Now, what would a nice man do? And I want to tell you that these kids don't want their boss to lower the standards. They just don't want it. And that's what makes it fun to work at Farrell's. At Farrell's, we expect you to be happy. We expect you to be friendly. You walk into one of these organizations, and you know we have a policy, you will be thanked 5 times that you came. 5 times. You'd better thank them 5 times. We're glad you came, and the busboy comes up, and he'll tell you he's glad you came. And a waitress will come up, and she'll tell you she's glad you came. And on the way out, the manager will let you know that he's glad you came, and then the cashier tells you the same thing. We're all glad you came. You're going to be contacted 10 times, not 9 times, 10 times while you're sitting there. Oh, you may not be aware of that, but I want to tell you, we like people. We like lots of people, and we want you to know that we like you. And we're not kidding either. We're selling friendship. We are really doing that. Now, in the meantime, we'll sell you some ice cream. But really and truly, we're happy people, and we're glad you came, and we want you to be happy while you are in our organization, and we're not going to tolerate an old crab in our organization. Now, if there's something that's wrong, we'll help you get it straightened out, but you can't be grumping around our place. Now, I expect you to be a cheerful fellow, too. Imagine anybody walking around this campus with a long face. And isn't that the emphasis around here, though, that we reflect the joy of the Lord? And that we have access to resources, spiritual resources, and we expect those resources to be operative in your life? At least around me, my only question is, if they're not working in your life and you talk to me, my only question is, why not? The resources are there, and it's up to you. The power is His, the choice is yours. Oh, what a wonderful thing to be around happy people, cheerful people. And I want to say once more, as I have said before, that one of the joys of my life is to go across the country somewhere where there are a group of crusade people that I can get together with. That's one of the joys of my life, the wonder of it all. And that we would just be so impressed with the wonder of it all. I think of the Apostle Paul. He was addressing the Romans, and in the first chapter of Romans, this is what he said in the 11th verse. I like this. He said, I long to see you. You know, that's so different, isn't it, from saying, oh no, are they coming over again? Not another meeting. I long to see you, that I might impart unto you some spiritual gift to the end that you may be established. Isn't it great to be walking around and running into people, and an individual will say, you gave me a boost. Someone else here says, you gave me a boost. You helped me when I was confused. You stood by me when I thought the end had come. The ambition to be the kind of an individual who wants to impart some spiritual gift to somebody else. The wonder of it all, that we can get to the place where we don't have to be so preoccupied with ourselves and our sensations and our problems and poor little me, and we can focus our attention on the other people, on the other fellow, that we can impart unto him some spiritual gift to the end that he may be established. That is, that I may be comforted together with you by the mutual faith both of you and me. And isn't it comforting to look around you and to realize that there are hundreds and hundreds of people who have access to the same power that I do, and as we yield our lives to that power, we see that the result is uniformly available to everybody? The realization of being part of somebody and willing to reach out and give of yourself to other people. And so this is the emphasis, too, in our business. The emphasis on, as far as this fellow who lovingly makes you a hamburger. Me. And we start talking about what can I do for Crusade? What can I do to enhance the effectiveness of this organization? I am come not to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give my life a ransom for many. Now, I'd like to call your attention to a few illustrations here tonight about Jesus' way of dealing with people. In Mark chapter 10, there is one of these illustrations. James and John approached Jesus, and this is what they said. They drew him aside. This is the 35th verse, and James and John, the sons of Zebedee, come unto him, saying, Master, we would that you should do for us whatsoever we desire. We'd like to make a little side deal with you, Lord. And he said unto them, what would you that I should do for you? And they said, grant unto us that we may sit one on the right hand and the other on your left hand in glory. Now that's really planning. These fellows are looking ahead. These fellows are interested in where they're going and what their situation is going to be. Listen to the way that Jesus handled it. He said unto them, you know not what you ask. Can you drink of the cup that I drink of and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with? And they said unto him, we can. And Jesus said unto them, you shall indeed drink of the cup that I drink of, and with the baptism that I am baptized with, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand and on my left hand is not mine to give, but it shall be given to them for whom it is prepared. And then you know what Jesus did? He called all the disciples together. And when the 10 heard this, they were much displeased with James and John. Now here's a technique that Jesus used time and time again, that out of a single situation, he would call the boys together and make the point to all the troops. And I guess these fellows learned very quickly that you don't make side deals with the Lord. And when the rest of them heard it, they didn't like it. Now, I wonder why Jesus did that. I believe he did it because there was a point that was too good to miss here, and he wanted them all to hear it. And this is what he said. And when the 10 heard it, they became much displeased. But Jesus called them to him, and he said unto them, you know that they which are accounted to rule over the Gentiles exercise lordship over them, and their great ones exercise authority upon them, but so shall it not be among you, But whosoever will be great among you will be your minister. And whosoever will be the chiefest among you will be the servant of all. For even the Son of Man came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give himself a ransom for many. He took the opportunity to teach all of the fellows the importance of giving yourself, the importance of a ministry. There's another illustration that I would like to share with you. It's in the 7th chapter of Mark. And this time, the disciples were being criticized by the people because they didn't wash their hands before they ate. Now, Jesus took the occasion to teach something. And starting with the 14th verse in Mark chapter 7, he called all the people the critics, the gripers. Mind you, the fellows were displeased with James and John, and Jesus called all these displeased together and taught them something. Now here were some people complaining. And Jesus called the people together, the ones who were complaining, to teach them something. I believe that's quite a technique. That's something for us to think about. We don't need to be afraid of the griper. We don't have to be just soothing people, draw them aside and petting each little individual person. I believe that it's much more important that you have a sense of being a part of the body here and that we melt together as one. Did you ever stop to think that the only time you're aware of your stomach is when it aches? When your stomach is functioning normally, you aren't aware of it at all. All right. One time, I was in a camp, and I dropped something on my big toe. Now, that's the first time in my life that I ever realized that I had a big toe. I guess I've had a big toe all my life. But, you know, after I dropped something on that big toe, I'd start out, ooh. And I had to walk careful. Why? Because my big toe hurt. Did you ever stop to realize that the only time you're aware of a part of your body is if it doesn't work right? Now, a big toe isn't really much. But I can remember stepping up on an airplane wing. Ooh! You know, I had to adjust my whole style of life in favor of my big toe. For days, I had to make allowance for my big toe. And I sure looked forward to the day when my big toe would go back to normal so that I could forget about it. Now, you know, a part of your body can cause an awful lot of trouble. And it doesn't have to be a very big thing either. I remember one time I was up in the state of Washington, looking at Mount Baker. I love that mountain. I've skied up there. You know, there's a ski lodge up there. Some of you fellows who've worked up in the Northwest, that's a good deal. If you can get yourself invited as a speaker at that ski lodge. It's a tremendous deal. You have a meeting in the morning, you ski all afternoon, and a meeting at night. What a calling. You know, sometimes people ask me what my work is. And when I'm up there at that fir ski lodge, well, I'll tell you, it's awfully hard for me to figure out whether I'm working or whether I'm not working. Work. Oh, work or... Oh, I'm not sure. Anyway, there I was standing in front of Mount Baker and a speck flew into my eye. And do you know, I could have cared less about my wife or my kids or my business. I didn't care about anything. There was only one thing I was interested in, and that was to get that speck out of my eye. And when I finally got it out, I couldn't even hardly find it on my handkerchief. But that little bitty speck took all my attention. And you know, gentlemen, one of you can create such a ruckus, or a few of you could create such a ruckus that the whole focus of everybody else would have to be on you because you aren't functioning the way you should. Now, I notice as I study the scriptures that Jesus was sensitive to the things that came between himself and the disciples, or he was sensitive about the things that divided those disciples, and whenever something did, he paused to make something out of it. He didn't overlook it. Now, we had this wonderful, inspiring message this morning, didn't we? About motivating people. But you know, in leadership, it's great to work with the ones you've motivated, but in leadership, you've got to do something about the ones that you can't motivate. But we do have to pause and deal with these people. Well, here was one of these situations. The disciples embarrassed Jesus. They didn't wash their hands. But Jesus called these complaining people together, and he made something out of it. Verse 14. When he called all the people unto him, he said unto them, "Hearken unto me, every one of you, and understand. There is nothing from without a man that entering into him can defile him." Now, there's a statement. You just think that one over. There is nothing from outside of you, entering into you, that can defile you. How about whiskey? How about tobacco? How about dope? Well, that's a thought starter, isn't it? There is nothing from without that entering into you can defile you, but the things which come out of you, those are they which defile you. And if any man have ears to hear, let him hear. Did you get it? How many of you got the point? Well, up to then I didn't. And when he was entered into the house from the people, his disciples asked him concerning the parable. Mind you, this all arose over the fact that they hadn't washed their hands, and that certainly isn't what they were talking about now when they drew aside. What they were talking about now is, what is this principle that you enunciated? He arrested their attention, that's for sure, and now they wanted some elaboration. What did he mean? And he said unto them, "Are you so without understanding also? Do you not perceive that whatsoever thing from without entering into a man, it cannot defile him, because it doesn't enter into his heart, but into his belly and out into the draught, purging all meats?" And he said, "That which comes out of a man defiles a man." Now listen, here is one of the tremendous gems, I believe, in the scripture. Here are the things that come out of a man. Evil thoughts originate within you. They're not put there. They're there. Now, you know, when you stop to think about that, I guess the advertising people, the pornographic people, understand that that there's a response from within. And they can elicit that response from you. What catches man's attention? Well, these advertising people, they know what is within man. One time I was in Lima, Peru. And there were about three different movie houses there. And every one of those three different movie houses had had the sexiest kind and the most violent kind of American movies. And someone was saying, this is what they see of America. And I was saying, no, that's not true. There are all kinds of movies available from America. Why don't they have travelogues here of America? You know why? That's what they chose. What determines what you choose? Well, it depends on what is within. And from within, out of the heart of men, proceed evil thoughts and adultery and fornication and murder. You see, these things originate from inside of you. It depends on what's there. I remember one time I was in my office counseling with a lady, a real nice-looking, friendly lady. An eyeful. And she would get up and pace the floor. And this time she walked around my desk, and the next thing I knew, I've got this nice, warm, lovely lady on my lap. Wow. Who wants victory then? There she was. I didn't ask for that, but I had a decision to make. What determined my decision? Her move? What determined my decision? It was the condition of my heart that determined my position. Now, that's what I call temptation. You know, sometimes we say the temptation is some terrible, awful, horrible thing. Why, that's no temptation. Temptation is something that is so feasible, it's so desirable, that it takes a conscious act of the will to reject it. And what you do about temptation depends upon the condition of your heart. It isn't everybody that commits fornication. It is not everybody that commits adultery. You always have a choice. I remember reading one time about a man who was dealing with a prostitute. And you know the approach he took to her? You didn't have to do it. You had some better options. What determines the choices you're going to make? It's the condition of your heart. And in this case, I firmly helped the lady back into her chair, and we went on with the counseling session. That's temptation. Now, you fellows run into situations like that all the time, don't you? We're maybe not like that, but the potential is there. You may, depending on the condition of your heart, pass up lots of signals. Keep your heart diligently, because out of it come the issues of life, say the Proverbs. What else comes out of this heart? Theft. You know, it's not everybody that steals. What determines whether you're going to take it or not? The fact that it's there? No, it's the condition of your heart. What else is in this heart? Wickedness. Deceitfulness. Have you ever shaded the truth? Have you ever handed somebody a line? Oh, it's easy for us. We wouldn't tolerate somebody that we know is involved with fornication or adultery, but we'll tolerate somebody who'll handle you a line. We'll tolerate somebody who has temper tantrums. Jesus said it all comes out of the same, it's the same product. Lust, an evil eye, blasphemy, pride, foolishness, all these evil things come from within. Now, do you remember the point that I was making? The point that I was making is this all started out of the fact that there were some people criticizing the disciples. And what a wonderful thing Jesus made out of all of this. And I believe that this is one of the challenges of leadership, that you take a difficult situation and really make something positive and constructive out of it. So that we can learn a lesson out of it. I don't know. I a few years ago here, I happened to be here one time and we went through a real crisis here. Bill Bright was there. There was some criticism. You know, out of that crisis, if I recall correctly, very shortly after that crisis came Bill's message on loving by faith. Here's one of the challenges of leadership. To turn a difficult situation into a positive one. I taught, and with this I will be closing, I taught for 4 years at Trinity Seminary, and I had all the senior seminary students, all of them had to go through my class. It was a counseling class, and we met 8 o'clock Monday morning. 8 o'clock Monday morning. The worst slot in the whole week. And most of these fellows had churches, and they would come dragging into there half asleep. And I was just amazed the first meeting, because it seemed clear that at least half these fellows planned on taking a nap in my class. I think that was their goal. And these fellows would slide down into their seats so the top vertebrate would hit the top of the seat and the bottom vertebrate the bottom of the seat. And they had this kind of a posture. And they sort of slid down into position as much as to say, "Prof, I'd like to see you teach me something." They were seniors. They were theologians. I'm a psychologist. What am I going to do? And what a challenge now to make something out of that class. This had been the counseling class. I don't know who taught it before me, but evidently it wasn't a good class, and these fellows didn't like it. There's a bad reputation in the counseling class, 8 o'clock Monday morning. So I pondered that. How am I going to make something useful and positive and constructive out of this? I guess there were 30 fellas in there. Smart fellas. So I said, "Gentlemen, sit up." And they sat up. They were startled. They really were. So was I. You know, a lot of times you have to go by trial and error. When you're in an unexpected situation, you can't just be suave and perfect. Oh, it's nice to pick nice, perfect illustrations, you know, your success stories out of the air, but there are all kinds of situations that you're plunged into, and there you are, and you got to do something right now. And I didn't know what else to do but to say to the fellas, "Sit up." And as I said, I surprised myself. And so I said to the fellows, "I surprised myself." But you know, I had to get your attention somehow. I hope I didn't offend you, but I did want to get your ear. Now, what we need to do here is to have an understanding about this class. I would just like to have a meeting of minds with you fellows. You know, there's a passage of Scripture even that would give you a basis for approaching things this way. For instance, in 1 Corinthians 1:10, I beseech you, brethren, by the name of the Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, and that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. And I'd just like us to get together, you know, so that we know what we're going to be doing in this class. By about then, in comes a couple of fellows. And a little later, in comes another fellows, and maybe 20 minutes after the class started, they were all there. Now, it just didn't seem like they intended to get there on time. And so I asked them this question. Would you consider it reasonable for me to expect you to pay attention? Anybody in this room that would object to the idea that a teacher has a right to have the attention of his students? Anybody? Nobody objected. Okay, then let's have that understood, okay? That when you come to class, I would like to have your attention. Now, is there anybody in this room that would have any objection to the proposition that it's reasonable to expect a student to come to class on time? Anybody here that would differ with that? Well, they looked at each other. But you know, nobody differed with it. Now, you'd say, well, who would differ with a prof? Well, anyway, they didn't differ with it. Now, I said, now, when there's some written work, I expect you to follow standard rules and procedures for composition. Anybody here that doesn't know what standard rules and procedures for composition are? Everybody knew. All right, are we agreed? Any questions? Anybody that doesn't understand, would you ask your questions? And nobody had any questions. You know, I went through this every semester for 4 years. Same procedure, same thing happened, it seemed, every time. So the next class, just as sure as we had the second class, over there is a fella. And pretty soon, he looks like this. Like that. Sound asleep. Now, what does a nice man do? Because I just got the notion that that fellow ought to hear what I have to say. Now, I don't mind a fellow not signing up for my class, but if you sign up for my class, I'd like you to be a part of the class. And so I would say to his buddy, would you wake him up? And so his buddy didn't want to wake him up. You know, his buddy was a nice guy and let him sleep. But I said to his buddy, wake him up. And so his buddy woke him up. And I said to him, do you realize what you've been doing? Yes, sir. What have you been doing? I've been sleeping. Do you remember what our agreement was? Yes, sir. But, Doc, you don't understand. I had a hard day yesterday. I have a church, and I'm tired. And it's all right. It's all right. If you want to sleep, go and sleep. Go to your room. That's perfectly all right. Check out. But don't park your body there and leave. I mean, either I want you all there or all or nothing. What? Then pretty soon in comes this fellow, late. You can expect people to test the limits when you set limits. Just as sure as you set limits, you can expect people to test them. And so in comes this fellow, and he's late. And so I stopped him right there at the door. Why are you late? And he gave me a dirty look. The teacher, he gives a dirty look. Why does he give me a dirty look? Because I asked him a simple question, why were you late? Now, isn't that a fair question? He said, there aren't any profs that demand this. Yes, there are. I demand it. And you know, that fellow wanted me to conform to the other profs. But I understood that I had the authority to set the standards in my own class. And I told the fellows, look, if you come late, don't come at all. Now, after all, you fellows are seminary seniors. You are pace setters. You're the models. The fellows in the lower classes look up to you. And pretty soon, you're going to take the lead in a church. And you want to be at your very best, don't you? Well, that fella came in and sat down. And like this. I said, what's the matter with you? You know what he was doing? He was sulking. A seminary senior sulking. You don't sulk in my class. I mean, you can sulk if you want, but you're not going to sulk in my class. And you know, I asked him to stay over after class. And you know what I talked to him about? I talked to him about whether or not he was interested in being a happy man. You know, you say you were at a church. You came late because you worked hard at your church. What would those people think if they saw the way you act in that chair this morning? Now, if you want to have a sense of self-respect, you can't be a sulking little boy on Monday morning and stand up and preach the truths of God during Sunday. And I want you to be the best preacher anybody ever had. What do you suppose ever happened to that class? Just as sure as we had a written assignment, somebody handed in a sloppy paper. I'd hand it back to him and say, you can't hand that in. Remember our agreement? He said, I don't care. Give me a D. I said, you can't get a D. You can't even hand it in. Well, don't I have any rights? You know, this is the United States, isn't it? I demand the right to write a sloppy paper. A senior in seminary, and you are arguing your rights to write a sloppy paper? You want to pass this course? You can't get through without passing this course. What do you suppose happened to that bunch? You know, one of the joys of my life as I travel around the country is to run into some of those men. And they greet me like a real buddy. You know, I can remember seeing some of those fellas tearing down the hall 2 minutes to eight. Where are you going? Brandt's class. And once I got those fellows past their bad habits, and once I got those fellows sitting around the Word of God and drinking it in and talking about how we're going to pass these things on and how we're going to make it operative in our lives first, and my thesis is that an effective counselor, first of all, it's not what he knows, it's who he is. Counseling, more than anything else, involves character. And there's a bond of love and affection that developed between those fellows and me. But you know, it's the difference between letting a thing rock along, and I cannot understand how a man would have a sense of self-respect, balancing himself on his top and bottom vertebrate, half asleep in a class. I cannot understand how a man would walk out of that classroom with any sense of self-respect. I would hate to see the day when Campus Crusade starts lowering its standards in order to make the boys happy. It's your reaction to the standard. It's what's within you that will be revealed because we have a standard. It's what is within you that defiles you. And I believe that one of the keys to this organization is the fact that the leadership of this organization has held up a standard. And the effort is to maintain a standard, not to sink to the level of the lowest common denominator. I remember one time, this was when the time changed to daylight savings time. And I would commute every Monday. I'd come from Flint, Michigan. I'd get on an airplane and commute to Chicago and teach my class and go back home again. And this day, I didn't realize it was a time change. And I'm looking at my clock, and it's pretty close to 8 o'clock, and I'm hurrying into my classroom, and to my amazement, the whole class is sitting there, and they had a spokesman, and the spokesman got up and said, "Why are you late?" And I said, "I am not late." And then he jubilantly pointed out to me that I was 1 hour late. And do you know every one of those fellows sat in that classroom because they sensed what was wrong, and they were all there for 1 hour waiting for me and to greet me and to let me know that I goofed. We had a wonderful bond of fellowship in that class. But I want to tell you, just like in our organization, Farrell's, why is it fun to work at Farrell's? Because we have a standard up here. Why is it fun to be in Crusade? Do you know something? I do a lot of consulting work with mission boards. And a mission board who has 25 candidates is tickled pink. I guess the biggest number that I know of any mission board that I know of, was 200 candidates. How come this organization has all these candidates? Did you ever stop to think the reason is that we have a standard? That we require something of you? That we expect you to go somewhere? And that you know where you're at? And that you can have a sense of accomplishment? And we're not satisfied to have a bunch of carnal, grumping, complaining people around? You know, I believe that we are in a very strategic leadership position. And one of the keys to it is the expectation that we have. The expectation of lifting a man to the highest level he can get to, and you're not satisfied with anything less. I remember one time I was heading for my class, and I left early Monday morning, and I left late. And I was in a hurry, and I looked back I noticed in my mirror this car with his light flashing, and I thought to myself, wow, I better pull over and let him pass. But he was after me. And he pulled over. Mind you, now I'm in a hurry. I'm going to miss my plane. And this fellow pulls over, and he nonchalantly gets out of his car, looks over his car, and then pretty soon he moseys over to my car and says, "You in a hurry, buddy?" I said, "Yes, sir, I'm in a hurry. I've got to catch a plane." I said, and I thought, now what am I going to tell that fellow? And so I told him this. I said, "You know, sir, I am a psychologist and a seminary professor, and I've got to get to Chicago to teach a class." I thought that would get him. You know what he said? He put his hands on his hips. He said, "What did you say? Did I hear you say that you're a psychologist and a seminary professor and you're speeding down this street? If we can't depend on people like you, who can we depend on?" Brother. And so he takes out his pad and takes his good old time and writes me a ticket and says, "Now, don't break the law." There was a nice man. Wasn't he? There was a man who was doing his job. That man got me to thinking more than any man in a long time. But, you know, I was disturbed kind of then, and I just got onto the airplane. And I'm sitting there, and a stewardess comes along and says, "Fasten your seatbelt." Now, who is she to tell me to fasten my seatbelt? Do you know what I did? I fastened my seatbelt. Was that girl doing her job? That afternoon, I have a radio broadcast, and I did it. I was doing it at Moody Bible Institute. Here is a kid. He is a freshman in a control room. He sticks up two fingers. He sticks up one finger, and then he goes like this. "Start talking." The freshman telling me when to start talking. Pretty soon, he sticks up two fingers, one finger, and he went like that. That meant stop talking. That kid telling me when to start and when to stop. And you realize that that's the way the world turns, isn't it? It's a matter of putting your neck under a yoke. You couldn't have a radio station unless there was some obedience involved. You turn on a station and you expect somebody to be prepared. You expect them to be on time. You expect them to quit on time. I say it's positive and constructive to pay attention to the people that you're responsible for and to make sure that at the points where they sag, that you bolster them up. And that you make something out of it. And my point to that pouting, sulking seminary kid was, don't you want to be the best leader any church ever had? What would your church think if they saw you now? And it seems to me that we can turn a problem into a positive, constructive thing if we can take that individual and give them a vision. And that's the challenge I'd like to leave with you. And I think as I study Jesus' life, that we see these illustrations where he would take a conflicting situation and make something constructive out of it. And this ought to be our goal, that when we look at a negative thing, that we look at it in terms of making something positive and constructive out of it. That, to me, is the challenge of leadership. Oh, yes, to pat the fellow on the back that is doing well, but he doesn't need it. He knows he's doing well. The important thing is to lift up the fellow whose knees are sagging. And may the Lord bless us and help us, that those of us who are in this room would covenant to the Lord that we're going to be the best campus crusade illustrations that anybody ever saw. Let's pray. Lord, I do pray for each one of us here. And when we realize the goals that we have ahead of us, and when we realize that the accomplishment of those goals rests on our shoulders, those of us who are contained in this room, I do pray for each one of us that we might be prepared to take anything that is negative, anything that would be a hindrance in our own lives, and put them under the blood, that we might truly be illustrations of your grace, realizing that we did not come to be ministered unto, but to minister and to give our lives a ransom for many. We ask it in Jesus' name. Amen.